Welcome back to the Missing More Amari podcast. I'm Tim. How's it going, Lance?
It's going pretty well. How are you?
Doing great. It's been a little while since our last episode, but we've been working on some stuff. So please don't assume that this feed has gone dark. It has not.
Right, exactly. Just to clarify, when we started this podcast, and I believe we've said this before, all of the information that has to do with the case was coming at a rapid pace because it was out there and we needed to talk about it. And, you know, so it was every week we would have something new as kind of the backstory to the whole case. But since we reached a certain point, we now talk about things after researching them. And it's very much like we're delivering news on the case. So to put something out there in a forced way just to get an episode out isn't really what Tim and I feel is the best thing to do with this podcast. So even though there are periods of time when nothing is being released, just know that we are working on topics and theories behind the scenes, and we release them as we see fit.
And I would like to congratulate you on this is probably the closest thing we're going to release to a one-year podversary. We've been doing this podcast for a year, and it's pretty remarkable the progress that we've made. The amount of downloads has been staggering, so I just want to say thank you to everybody out there, and please continue to spread the word about this podcast, this case, and our upcoming documentary.
And that's a great segue into the interview that we have now. This interview, it took a little bit of convincing for our subject. We did the interview so that people who were there during the search, directly involved in the search, maybe they'll hear this gentleman's voice and they'll come on, or maybe something will jog loose in their memory and they can email us, or they can give us a call and they can provide more information. But it is a step in the right direction as far as getting right back to the scene and to the search.
Rick Graves is our interview tonight. And we were able to put together some information through our conversations with Rick before we started, before we actually agreed to be on the podcast. So Rick had mentioned something about a cabin that maybe one of Maura's friends knew. These are things that he had heard a while ago. And he said, ask the Murrays about it. We asked the Murrays about it and got back an email, is this the one you're talking about? And it was a link to the UMass Outing Club cabin. So that was when we were first introduced to the Outing Club cabin, in time to ask the police about it, because I feel like there would be more speculation going on if we hadn't got that answer from the police, right? If they never answered it, I feel like for me, I would be convinced she was headed there.
Absolutely.
But as it stands, I'm not convinced. I still think it's a strong possibility, though.
And it's really interesting to hear what Rick has to say about that, how his theories leading up to in the past 12 years were one way, and certain people that they looked at as suspects or had knowledge of her disappearance, and then this cabin news came up, and what he has to say about it is really surprising to me. Hopefully somebody out there will hear this, and they'll have more information on it. We've actually, since the interview, gathered some information on this cabin and what level of knowledge people had affiliated with UMass. So we're compiling that information. We'll release that soon. But again, we want to make sure we do it in a responsible way.
Right. And this being the 1 year podversary, it sort of got me thinking, are we still going to be doing this a year from now? And I'm sure we're not going to put out 29 episodes if we are still going a year from now, probably more like 10 or something like that. But I thought that, yes, we probably will be, unless this case is solved and it's an apparent suicide. And the reason is because of the information that came about through our conversations behind the scenes with Rick Graves and our contacts with the Murrays and other people. So it's just, we saw it firsthand, and it's not the first time this has happened on the podcast, but we saw it firsthand that the more you shake the tree, the more apples can fall from it.
And that is the challenge with doing this podcast and being a part of this case and making the documentary on this case. Just when you think you've brought something to some sort of conclusion, it always happens where another element will come about, take you by surprise, and actually be legit enough where you have to follow up on that. And that is the case with this cabin.
And one of the other things I love about this interview, Lance, is the way that Rick talks about Mr. Murray, and he was very close to Fred during those searches very, very early on. And so it's really interesting to hear from someone who has no familial relationship speak about Fred in such a positive way.
Yeah, and the relationship that he had with Fred did seem to be positive, according to him. And it's pretty interesting that they had such a relationship during such a dark time. And it's also really tragic how he said a couple of times after the third year, it just kind of petered out. And you can hear it in his voice. He's a really genuine guy. That was one of the things that I liked about the interview, is that it was really tough to talk to him because he has a lot of information. He was there 12 years ago gathering information. He said he has notes everywhere. You can actually kind of hear him going through his notes during the interview. But he's trying to get it all uncluttered from his head, because you can tell after the third year, he said, you know, we just needed to move on and get on with their lives. But he still has all that information. And by doing this interview, I think one of the reasons why he was really hesitant to do it was, I don't know how much he wanted to pull that out of the attic. I feel like he thinks he should have prepared a little better for it, but I don't think that that would, 12 years later, I don't think there's any preparation for, you know, pulling these things out of his head and not knowing what we're going to ask him. And he's got to really try to remember because a lot of stuff happened during that time. And hopefully this isn't the only time that we interview him.
So we hope you enjoy it, and we'll be back soon with more Missing More Murray.
I also want to reiterate that if you are listening to this and you were part of the search crew, or you were close to the investigators or close to the family, and something does jog your memory listening to Rick talk about all this, if he's accurate on some details, if he's hazy on other details, please reach out to us. He's doing the best he can with his memory 12 years later and all of the details that are in his brain on this and what he's written down in notes. So that being said, we won't tease this any longer. Let's roll the interview and let the listeners hear it for themselves.
Welcome to the podcast, Rick Graves. Very nice to talk to you on the air, and thank you very much for appearing. I know it's sort of been a journey talking with you, and I'm really glad you finally decided to do the podcast.
Yeah, I'm not very much of a speaker or anything, but I'm going to do the best I can and answer some questions. Hopefully it will help.
For my behalf, just want to say thank you as well. It did take a little bit of convincing to get you on, but I really feel, and I know Tim really feels this as well, the things that you say and your experiences with the disappearance and with the search, I feel is very, very important for our listeners to hear. Kind of give them a visual, put them in that environment at that time. And who knows, maybe somebody who is listening, who knows a person similar to yourself in that position back then, maybe they hear your voice and they decide that they want to come on too, because they see the good that can be done with you, with someone like yourself coming on.
I hope I can make some sort of difference just being on here. You know, it's gone on long enough, and I got out of it back in 3 years into it. I was 3 years into it, and I got out of the blogs and everything, because everybody started bashing each other, and it was making no sense. Until your podcast came up, that's and I just came across it on New Year's Eve and started listening to it. That a lot of that made sense. It was great that you guys did this.
Thanks a lot.
So yeah, let's take it right to the beginning. Let's talk about when you were first introduced to the case and what you were doing at the time, you know, maybe in your life, and how your life transitioned into the Maura Murray case.
Yeah, I used to, back about that time, I was searching for a couple of aircraft. I it was just a hobby. I searched for aircraft. There was one Learjet that disappeared. They finally found that. That was out in Warren, New Hampshire, on Smart's Mountain. and that had been missing for a couple of years. I get into that and tried to help the family out on that. And, and did a lot of investigating on that Learjet, especially, like, Lance, like you said, I think you said Jaffrey, New Hampshire?
Correct.
Yeah. And I did a lot of searching around Keene and Jaffrey. Actually took a helicopter out of Jaffrey. This guy was... Jaffrey, I think, has a little airport. I was surprised when I got there. It looked like this helicopter. He brought it out of the hangar, and he had to unfold the wings and everything. It looked like it had a Briggs & Stratton engine on the back.
But, right.
But it was a good helicopter. I went up. We did a lot of searching down around that area. But anyway, I got on this other aircraft out in Massachusetts. And actually, this guy had... he had a house, I believe it was right around Jaffrey. He had a second house that he had, house guests staying at. So we figured he probably crashed in between Massachusetts and going up to Jaffrey. Yeah, so I did a lot of searching out there on that. And then while I was on that one, this guy that I knew from that one, he heard about this Maura Murray, missing person, so he got into that, and then he asked me to take a look at it. So I took a look at it, and just got seriously involved with it, for about 3 years.
Before we get too far, I just want to ask how you got into searching for missing planes in the first place, and what is this curiosity in you that comes out to make you interested in searching for missing things?
Right, because this isn't something you do professionally, right?
No. I just got into it. Just got into investigating. I was able to get a lot of records out of a lot of people under the Freedom of Information Act order. Since 9/11 happened, then that kind of went by the wayside, because you got to prove a lot that you need that information now. Back then you didn't. They'd give you anything. Mm-hmm. I was just... intrigued by aircraft, and I used to work at the Portland International Jetport up here in Portland, and I just like planes, I guess. Maybe it was a past life of mine.
Your work investigating must have been good enough for that other man to invite you to look at Maura's case, and I know I don't believe you want to say his name, right?
No, I'd rather not.
Okay, so we won't say his name.
I'd rather keep a lot of names out of this, on respect for them.
That's fine. We have heard this person is still investigating, so yeah, it's good. It keeps a very low profile, but this person is reportedly still investigating the Maura Murray disappearance as well, so... just wanted to give a little background, because I know we were going to get that question if we didn't ask you.
Yeah, he's a nice guy, and he was, I guess, what you'd call as a searcher like me, trying to help people out and, solving these mysteries. I've never been on a missing persons case before, the Maura Murray case. It's more heartbreaking, of course, because you're searching for a person. Even in these aircraft, there are people, but, it's a little bit more personal, I think.
So this person who got you involved in the case, this was during your search for one of the aircrafts, and this person approaches you and says, you need to check this out. What was your initial thoughts when you looked at the details of, or not the details, but what was your initial impression when you looked at the basics of the case?
I just felt that, something's definitely wrong here. It doesn't seem right. Why can't they find this person? I pondered on it for about a week, and then I said, I'm going out there. So I headed out there after about a week, which was about 2 to 3 weeks after she went missing. And, just went out there and started talking to Fred, met up with Fred, talked to him. And
was it easy to approach Fred?
Yeah, because this person told me the hotel that Fred was staying at. So yeah, and he was welcoming to me. I didn't have any problems with him whatsoever.
I want to put the listeners' heads back in that place because you looked into the case in 2004. And there was no blogs written about this. There was very little, there was no online chatter about it. You looked up this case on your own and then decided to go assist. You decided to go help the family. It's pretty impressive because, I just need to get the listeners to, because everybody can look up all sorts of details and all sorts of information on this case now. But back then, that didn't exist. So just, imagine doing that. Imagine just hearing about something, looking it up on your own when it's so new, and then you only waited a week before you made the decision that it was important enough for you to go out there and look for. It's just impressive to me that someone has resolve like that.
Yeah, a lot of people, that were around me, my father, everybody couldn't understand why I was taking all my time and putting it into this stuff, and it was difficult for other people to swallow why I'd be doing this. I was 39 years old at the time, right around there, 39 or 40. I was a lot younger. I just got involved with it.
And did it take a toll on the rest of your life?
Oh, of course. Oh, yes. Yeah, it did. I think my relationship at that time of Maura Murray was a little bit in trouble anyways with a girlfriend. But, but I
can't. This is what put you over the top.
Yeah. And, it was kind of my time away for my me time. And she had a couple of kids and I really wasn't used to that. So, it was my time away.
And looking back on it now, was it worth it? Would you go back and do the same thing again?
In a different way.
Gotcha.
As far as the girlfriend and everything goes.
You would have broken up with her before you started searching?
it was the kids. That's the only reason I stayed, pretty much with her as long as I did, was the kids. I love kids they used to call and contact me all the time. I made a difference in their lives too.
That's nice. Yeah. Before we get into a search day, a typical search day, just curious how often you searched with Fred.
When I went out there, I met Fred. After that first day, I came home and I said I can't do it no more. It's very heartbreaking to go out there and not find anything.
That was after the first day?
Yeah.
Wow.
I went out there it's very heartbreaking not to find anything. And I said, I told her I wasn't going to go do it again. Well, the next weekend comes and I had thought about it all week and I said, I'm going back out there. So every weekend, I was out there pretty much, quite a bit for every weekend, that first year, searching with Fred. And there were a few weekends in between, a couple of here and there that Fred couldn't make it. And I'd go out there and search down stuff that he had because he had to work. I had to work too. And then there were weekends I couldn't be out there, but other people would go up and help Fred out as well.
Consistently for a full year, on some level, that area was searched every single weekend.
Consistently, yes.
And what areas did you cover, or do you feel comfortable saying that you believe Maura is not going to be found there now? Obviously right near the crash site, but what other areas in the woods did you guys really get deep into?
Well, you couldn't do a whole lot of foot searching at that time because there was so much snow. So basically, at the first start of it, you look for footprints, and everything. That was the biggest part of it, or places where you could that were actually plowed out that you can pull into. We'd search those areas. Towards the springtime, of course, when the snow melted, we could get out deeper and go deeper. We kind of did a circle, starting from the center and working our way out all the way. And, we covered quite a perimeter.
How many of you were searching at once?
Well, it was, let me see. It was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'd say between 4 to 6. 4 to 6, usually. He had some distant cousins or some relatives or something that would go out there just for support. And that helped out a lot.
But you feel comfortable that the areas that you covered, you guys wouldn't have missed a body?
No, we probably wouldn't have. No, we covered quite a distance and quite an area.
Overall, how many miles would you say, if you could give radiuses, say we covered within 5 miles of this place or 5 miles of this place, do you have any sense of what distances you covered in those areas?
Well, when it was all said and done, I'd probably say about 15 to 20 miles around. It would be a rough guess.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we covered it pretty heavily.
So for everyone listening, I just want you, because what I'm thinking right now is my proximity to a certain city, which is about half of that. So everyone listening, think about someplace that's 20 miles from you. That was what was consistently covered and searched for a year. Now, it wasn't, all at once, of course, but for a year within a 20-mile radius of that area. And nothing was found. Not even an article of clothing.
Not an article of clothing. Of course, we'd look for anything. We'd look for a cell phone, bottles of alcohol. Actually, one of the first days I went out there, I did find it was a brand new empty bottle of vodka. And we searched that area high and low. It looked like it was just thrown out a car window or something.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know if she had vodka on her or not, but yeah, it looked very fresh.
Like fresh, like the label wasn't faded or anything?
Yeah, it looked like it had been thrown out, the night before.
Where did you find that?
That was off of the line, it's called the Line Kiln Road.
Okay.
Yeah, and I can't remember the area too well now. I think that's up towards Bradley Hill, French Pond Road area.
Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, I found that pretty much right off.
Did you take it?
No. Yeah, Tim and Kathleen were with me when I found it. But yeah, we didn't take it. We just made note that. And that could be a good area to search. So
we
hit that area hard and heavy.
What kind of contact did you have with law enforcement at that time, or did Fred have with law enforcement that time, or you guys as a collective group?
Fred had all the contact with law enforcement. I never talked to law enforcement at all out there.
When you found this vodka bottle, were you, was there any rumor, or were you aware that she had alcohol in the car, or was that information presented to you at a later time?
No, Kathleen knew about it, that she had alcohol with her. And I don't know whether she saw the videotape at the liquor store when she bought the alcohol. I'm kind of thinking that Kathleen might have seen the videotape because she commented on the shoes that she was wearing.
When did Kathleen comment on on Maura's shoes?
Oh, this is right after it started. Because we were going over everything, and and one of the things was what she might have bought at the liquor store, and I thought Kathleen said she had viewed the tape. I don't know whether that's true or not. I don't know how she would know that she was wearing those shoes.
So how did that come up?
No, because I was going over everything, Yeah, she said that they have cameras from an ATM or something and from a liquor store.
When did she mention, how did it come up in conversation about her shoes?
I don't know. It just came up through, me asking questions.
Oh, okay. I know it's so long ago, it's tough to
remember. I think I was just asking questions about, security cameras and surveillance cameras.
What kind of shoes was she wearing?
I think she might have said some. They're like a rubbery type of shoe, like a water shoe or something. I don't know. It was a weird type of shoe. It wasn't
like Crocs or something.
I don't even know what those are. I'm not familiar with those. But
it wasn't a running shoe.
It wasn't a running shoe, and something she probably shouldn't have been wearing that night.
It was a casual shoe, something you'd wear, almost like slippers, I'm getting the feeling?
Yeah, something along that line.
Oh, okay, wow.
Yeah, I remember looking it up online with Kathleen, and she pointed them out, and I said, those are a weird pair of shoes.
Like Birkenstocks?
I don't know. I don't know shoes.
Yeah, but it just sounds like something that you wouldn't be trekking outside in snow in. It sounds like it would sink right in really quickly and get your feet soaked, which is a very bad situation if anyone's ever been in that situation. I know I have.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So, please take us through a typical search day.
Well, they all varied. Basically, I would head out there on a Saturday. Sometimes I would have a slow day at work on Saturday and be able to head out there early. Some days it was heavy. I wouldn't get out there until 9 o'clock. But then, we'd grab a bite to eat. We'd go to a restaurant or a bar and grab a bite to eat and have a beer. The good thing about this was people knew us and making us known around that area. At least the owners of these establishments could, if they heard somebody talking, if they heard something, they would come directly to us and tell us.
That's great. And was that a strategy that you guys ran with, sort of talking to bar owners and trying to keep your ear out at certain restaurants?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because one thing I want to clarify with everyone interested in the case, there's a little bit of a misconception out there that, the typical search day might start around 9:30 or 10 o'clock and Fred would go for a jog and then you might go out and search a little bit. But, everyone would head back to a bar and there'd be drinking. And then the excuse was used, well, I was just trying to overhear people's conversations. Was it anything like that?
No, it was kind of like that. You're talking about a little time searching, and we would beat the hell out of those woods that day, gravel pits, woods, everything, we're pretty worn out when we get out of the woods and go grab a bite to eat and sit down and have a beer. But yeah, that was the end of our day, and it gave us a chance to thrash over on what we were gonna do the next day. If we didn't leave that day, usually that was a Saturday night. Everybody pretty much showed up there on a Saturday, So we go out searching for a while, beat the hell out of ourselves, go to a bar, you know, grab a beer, and we'd have a good time. It took Fred's mind off of a lot of stuff. It's hard being in that position as a father to be out there. Thank God he had some company helping him through it. You know, he's got a great sense of humor, and at times he was comical, but at times you would see him down and out.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a misconception or part of it's truth, part of it's misconception.
Yeah, I think people have a hard time understanding that, you know, like you said, you beat the hell out of the woods and you're going strong in that like thick, dense woods. You go out and you get a burger and you get a beer to unwind. And I think it's a hard concept for people to realize that everybody's human. If Fred cracks a joke during one of those dinners, it doesn't mean that he doesn't care about looking for his daughter anymore.
That's right. Yeah. No, in my mind, Fred's a nice guy. You know, I respected him. You know, he did what he could at the time.
So when you're first heading into the woods, where's your head at, and where's the heads at of the searchers going in the woods? Like, what are you gravitated towards, and what do you say? You know, what do you discount?
Yeah, this would happen around the springtime, of course, not the wintertime. Going into woods and we'd basically search areas downhill instead of, you know, not so much uphill, because. You're not going to find much uphill. You're going to find, you know, more stuff downhill.
That's interesting. Why is that? That's actually the first I've heard anything like that. That's interesting.
If you're driving your car and you were to throw something out of your car window, let's say, you more tend to throw it on the downhill slope rather than on the uphill slope. It's just the way it is. If you were to try to get rid of a body, you would do it on a downhill slope and not drag it up a hill.
Were those actual thoughts that were going through people's? Was that verbalized?
I don't know if it was verbalized. I think it was more of a gimme than anything.
Wow.
You know, it's just something you just think of.
So it was sort of like you were trying to get into the heads of someone who disposed the body and where they would have done that, as opposed to in the head of Mora, someone who people say, you know, ran off into the woods to drink herself to death.
Yeah, and I don't see much of that happening. It doesn't really matter what she did to go out there to get away. But, the truth of the matter is she's missing and that's what you got to focus on. It doesn't really matter before that time what drove her out there. To me, it doesn't. It matters that she's missing, and for what reason, it doesn't matter. She's missing. So that's what the focus has to be on.
But for all intents and purposes, you were looking for a body, not where, like you said, it's unlikely that they, you know, that she would have gone uphill or her body would have ended up uphill, because you did not believe that she wandered into the woods and wandered uphill. So essentially you were looking for a murder victim.
That and other stuff. Like I said, the cell phone, bottles of liquor, everything like that.
Okay. And so that was the mindset of basically everybody out there. No one said, hey guys, let's, why don't we search up this to the top of this peak? Cause if I was going to drink myself to death, I'd go up there to enjoy the view. No one verbalized anything like that or sort of combated the idea that you were searching for what is essentially a body.
No. No, when we talked about it, we're going out there to search for anything. It didn't matter, you know, what it was. It was for a piece of something to connect to Mora. Well, whether we happen to be on, you know, stumble upon a body, you know, and there, it wasn't really talked about. You know, we were just searching for anything.
Right. So what I'm getting is at that time, it was just sort of assumed that Maura was taken by a dirtbag.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was very highly assumed. You know, Fred said it all along that that's what he believes. He believes somebody grabbed her. Now, in my opinion now, and I want to bring this up before I forget about it, is this cabin thing that came up with the UMass cabin. Now, I was thinking a lot about it. See, Moore didn't know that area that she crashed a car in. She never went off that exit before with her father. When they did all their hiking, they get off of 93 in Lincoln, New Hampshire. They never get off of that exit. And if she was going out towards the Lincoln area, she would have gotten off that exit that she knew. Not out towards the Lincoln area. But she got off this other exit off of 91. So my belief, I strongly believe, that she was going to someplace out in that area. And she didn't know that area. She would have known the area from Lost River over to Lincoln. Lost River is on Route 112. She would have known that area from there on, but either she got off of that exit because the car wasn't running, right? But I highly believe she got off of that exit for someplace in that area. She was definitely headed there. And that UMass cabin makes perfect sense.
Okay, so you didn't know about the UMass cabin back then, and this is news to you just recently as it came to us.
Yes. Yep.
And so Fred didn't know about it either. No one had ever searched that area, to your knowledge.
I don't believe so. I don't think I ever heard that UMass cabin. We did hear of some guy that she might have been seeing down there had a cabin up in that area, but there was no way to put it together. No way to find out who it was that had a cabin up in that area. And I don't even know where I came with that information. I believe it might have been through a family member, but...
That Maura might have been seeing somebody who had a cabin up there?
Yes, yeah. But yeah, it wasn't known where it was or anything. And knowing where this cabin is now, we did searches down that road. We have been down that road a lot of times.
Yeah, it's interesting that it was never brought up to you guys who were searching, because it seems pretty obvious right there with that connection that the dots should have been connected, that could have been the cabin that she was going to, if that's what she was doing, you know, meeting a new boyfriend or you know, a new friend or something like that.
How, you know, we'll go back to the searching for a year consistently, that information was never like even accidentally stumbled upon. But again, like, we're talking back in 2004 and 2005 and 2006, you know, the information wasn't at their fingertips the way it is now, but still, maybe the police knew about it and just didn't. It's just frustrating, right? I mean, it's like it was right there. It was right there the whole time.
Yeah. And so do you believe that Maura's old assistant track coach, Hussein Baghdadi, was the man that one of the family members mentioned that she might have been seeing?
It was spoken upon about that she might have been seeing somebody from school, that she liked somebody from school. But I'm not sure if anybody knew who that really was at that time.
But you don't believe it was someone other than that, or there's no reason to believe it was a different guy?
I think back then I had thought it was a teacher.
Oh, really?
But yeah, but...
Yeah, but that's kind of similar.
Yeah. 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 Assistant coach, chief teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was actually, like I said, an hour before we talked, I was just researching a few things. And on Renner's blog, And this guy I'll call Hoss. I guess that's what they nickname him, Hoss.
Yep.
But he, I guess Runner talked to him. And this guy said she was also seeing other people from the track team. It bugs me because that's my feeling now is these people need to be really talked to. I'm amazed nobody's come forward on anything. Even Hoss, I guess. Did you guys try to contact him at all?
Yeah, we haven't had any luck, and I know that Renner had tried as well after the news story about the UMass cabin came out, and I don't believe Haas has gotten back to Renner, but it's hard to tell how much he gave law enforcement, because I believe James Renner doesn't think that he told law enforcement everything he told Renner. I have no idea how much they talked to him. We can't know unless we talk to him.
Yeah. I mean, that's my feeling right now is with his cabin, that sheds a whole different light on everything.
During the searches, were any of her friends, like the Sarah Alfieri or Kate Markopoulos or any of her UMass friends, did they ever participate in the searches?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Did anybody from your search or investigation, to your knowledge, speak to them?
Only Fred, I believe, was the only one. I don't think anybody else did.
And nothing that Fred learned from them was necessarily applied. Maybe it wasn't useful in what you guys were doing.
What he knew of Sarah and Kate, they didn't give any information on something that was out of the ordinary or anything like that.
Or they didn't give any information on a certain cabin that was owned by UMass that she might have been going to. I guess that's where my second part of the question was coming from, was that if there was communication with her friends, it would seem, I would think that her friends would say, hey, it might be a possibility that she went up to the cabin, the UMass cabin.
No, Fred wouldn't have known about it.
Right, exactly. So if he had known, you guys would have, it wouldn't have been a surprise to you 12 years later to hear that there was a cabin.
So in addition to the searches that you helped with Fred, I know you took on some other duties. What other duties did you take on with Fred?
He actually put me in charge of contacting the psychics that were calling in, taking down their reports. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it got quite extensive on the psychic reports and everything, because when we had nothing to, we didn't have any leads or anything, we'd search on these psychic reports that would come in, and from the start, I think the very first one, this one psychic came up with the word Jenkins, or he said some sign on a cabin, on a log cabin, has the name Jenkins. We're looking for stuff like that. We took all the psychic reports into account and tried to follow up on what we could on them. Mm-hmm. There was a keyword like mojo was another keyword that a psychic came up with.
What else did you do with Fred? I know you helped him with some of his Freedom of Information Act documents, right?
Okay, yeah. Freedom of Information Act. I was able to get a lot of stuff on the aircraft searches, like I said, on the Freedom of Information Act order. At that time, you could get the documents. After 9/11, they sent you back a notice stating it was a new act that came out. It kind of counteracts the Freedom of Information Act order, and it's called the Right to Know Act. So now you got to go to court and prove you need the right to know on having these documents. it's a lot harder to get records now than it was back then.
But you helped him put together some of the things that he used to submit to New Hampshire.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't know the legal aspects of stuff, but yeah. So I helped him out a little bit there. What I could, what I knew.
I just want to get back to the searches a little bit, real quick.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff did you find, or what kind of interactions in the woods did you have? I know you had some run-ins with some animals. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, there was a couple of times, one time really stands out with me. We were down a dirt road, and there was a red pickup sitting there, and over the other side of the red pickup was a downhill. So, we searched around the red pickup, and then searched around the downhill, and down the hill a little bit were plastic bags. So we opened up one up and saw some hair. Fred really he was broken up. So he went and called 911. And we were told by the police, don't touch anything. So then the police came and opened up the bags and found out it was actually deer. There's one desolate place that we were searching. It was pretty desolate. And we came across this moose, and somebody cut the head off the moose and just left the moose there.
So a headless moose as well in the woods.
How many people were involved in the when you discovered the bags? Were they trash bags that had this hair in it?
Yeah, they were pretty fresh bags.
And how many people, so you're going downhill, how many people were there? And Fred was right there with you?
Yeah, yeah.
And you called 911. Did you call from did Fred call from a cell phone?
Yes, yeah. I think he had walked down the road a little bit, get a signal, but yeah.
What was Fred... How is he acting? I mean, was he, obviously this must have been very emotional for him to find out, or to find this, and then to find out what I think was pretty shortly after was deer. Like, what were his reactions? What was his emotional state when he found that out? Was he relieved?
Yeah, he was relieved, but he had been shooken up quite a bit. It took a lot to get over that. It wasn't a laughing matter, by no means. It was very emotional. It was very emotional for him. It was very emotional for the rest of us. You don't know what to expect, and then you have to back off and wait for the police to show up because you don't want to disturb any evidence. It was quite emotional.
Was this the first instance where you had that kind of jolt that something might be discovered? Some sort of, a body, or was this, how many times did this happen, I guess?
That was the only time I saw, well, no, I mean, within my experience, I was going home one day from searching, and I was going down, I went down Route 18, I believe it's 18, it goes to, towards Warren, I believe, and I was searching the hillside down there, and over the hillside it had just snowed, and this was pretty much towards the beginning, I believe, it had just snowed out. The snow was pretty deep, and I remember I only had my sneakers on because we didn't do a lot of foot searches at that time. But I looked down over this hill and I saw blood everywhere, so I had to go take a look. So I went down there, and again, it was deer thrown over the in plastic buckets, mind you. Deer parts entrails, I guess, it's what it's called, down there. But that was a little scare for me.
Did you call the police on that?
No.
Or you could recognize that it wasn't human?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did situations like that, seeing this, the decapitated moose and the deer entrails and the blood, what does that do to your psyche? What does that do for your motivation looking for? I just feel like it's a bunch of these like false alarms that are actually kind of creepy in themselves. Did it make this like whole experience? It just feels like these like dark moments.
Well, see, you can tell, but by these moments that there are people, you know, taking deer out of season out there. I don't believe deer hunting season goes into February.
I don't even think there is a moose hunting season.
So, you know, people are just taking them and dumping them. But you know, it goes on everywhere. I used to be a hunter, so it doesn't really bother me too much to find these remains.
You had mentioned on a previous call that we had about a dirt road where you saw a sign about trespassers will be shot. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we just came upon this dirt road. I believe that was on Route 116 going towards Franconia. You know, so we just figured we'd drive down this dirt road, just check it out. I mean, you know, it's a simple dirt road, even though there's a sign out there, you know. Sometimes we, you know, if it was on somebody's house or something, we'd respect that, but it was just on a dirt road. But, yeah, we went down there, and then both me and Fred, it was just me and Fred that day. And we started coming back down off of the dirt road, and yeah, there was a guy out there saying, if my uncle was here, he'd shoot you right now.
Wow.
Did you have a chance to explain what you were doing there?
Oh, yeah, but he was really, really upset.
So they would have shot you anyway?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm like, yeah, you're going to jail if you shoot me. I mean, you know, whether you're trespassing or not, you can't really shoot somebody unless they're breaking into your house.
With knowing that these signs are out there and people are up there willing to open fire, could this have possibly happened to Mora, in your opinion?
No. No.
Why is that?
I don't see it happening. I just see that she got picked up by a dirtbag, or I don't know, or something happened in that cabin that night. And my high belief on that cabin is people, the log with UMass needs to be looked at with that club there that owns that cabin. Needs to be looked at, see if it goes back that far now, but and see if some people can be located that were at that cabin after that time, to see what they might have saw, footprints, any sign of disturbances or anything like that.
Right.
It sounds like to me like this cabin might be just a party spot for UMass students.
Sure seems like that's the case, yeah. Because there's not enough room to party at UMass.
Right. If you don't mind taking us to your experience with the A-frame house, we have a lot of discussion that goes on concerning that location.
Yeah, the A-frame house, I don't put much credit into. But that was pretty much Fred's. He came up with somebody that... came to him stating his brother said something about something. I don't really know the whole story, but there was a bloody knife in his truck, and you know, his brother, basically this guy's brother was turning him in. And I think he's passed away now.
Yeah. Lawrence Moulton, yep, talked to Fred and handed him a rusty knife and said his brother Claude, he believes, might have been involved and was acting weird around that time and was also living in the A-frame house, I believe.
Okay, that brings back some memories, those names. I tracked down Claude Moulton, a friend of Claude that worked with Claude Moulton, and I tracked him down up around Bangor, Maine. I went and up there and talked to him, and he said he would invite Claude Moulton to his house anytime. He thought he was a nice guy and everything, and so I really don't give him much credit other than the brother was just looking too much into something.
Now, what do you know had been done with any carpet samples or any blood stains that were found in the A-frame house? Was that anything that you were involved in?
Yeah, that was a search that went on with the League of Investigators. They got involved, John Healy. I guess, you know, they pretty much did a lot of it pro bono. And I think they pretty much did it for no cost. Yeah, so John Healy, you know, ran it. And I believe he did that search for that girl out of Massachusetts. I forgot her name.
Molly Bish.
Yeah, Molly Bish. And, I believe he was involved with investigating that as well. You know, the League of Investigators came in, and they took over, you know, searching the A-frame house. A carpet sample was taken out of there because the dogs hit on it. One of the League of Investigators had the carpet, and I was in touch with him. And, he told me he was going to do a luminol study on it, see if it was blood that was actually there. But I hadn't heard anything. I turned it over to Fred, gave Fred the information on it. And so Fred took that over.
I know there has been some speculation and theorizing and maybe even, I dare say, rumors about the possibility that Maura was pregnant at the time of her disappearance. What do you know about that? And did Fred look into this? Did you have conversations about this?
Yeah, a little bit. And, you know, it was theorized. It wasn't a known fact or anything. We looked at everything. Any answer to why she might have been up in that area? Who knows? She might have been going into rehab or something like that. Or pregnancy or. So, an abortion clinic. We looked at everything. We looked at sexual predators in the area. Everything was looked at. We looked at, serial killings around the U.S. Everything had to be looked at. And, you know, this was everything was immediately just talked over and looked at.
I love hearing about that and that Fred was so open to looking at all angles. I think that speaks a lot to his lack of involvement in anything to do with Maura's disappearance. You know, I feel like some people still kind of glob onto that, and it sounds really ridiculous the longer we do this show that he knew where she was going or that he had something to do with it or anything like that. So I love to hear these stories from you, Rick, about him looking into that possibility. And I know there was another story, a report that he followed up on about someone who looked like Maura who was dancing on a bar nearby.
Yeah, and this... We got a couple of reports. This happened, I think, towards the third year. I think it was late second year, towards the third year. That in Rochester, New Hampshire, I think somebody had saw Maura on the news, and maybe when that Discovery Channel first aired or ID Channel first aired. That documentary. Mm-hmm. It might have been right after that. But, so somebody called in and reported seeing Maura at a bar dancing on the bar, and so we looked into it. We looked heavily around Rochester, New Hampshire. I actually went to that bar one night with my girlfriend and kind of, just sat there around the bar and staked it out a little bit. But nothing became of that. There were no other sightings around that area.
Did you tell your girlfriend that's why you were there?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Okay.
When you say you got a call, like, where does the call come in, and how does it? Did people like when someone sees the picture on the news and then they think that it was Maura dancing on a table in a bar? Who are they calling, and how does that information get to Fred or get to yourself?
Yeah, they would call, you know, the family number that was out there, I believe. I don't know. Actually, I really don't know. But, it certainly wasn't my number. But, no, it was Fred that came up with it somehow. And he had talked a couple of times with that girl in Rochester that said he saw her. And she swore it was her. Then we had another report. I believe that was around New Hampshire, Lake Winnipesaukee area. I believe it was, it might have been Meredith, but it was around Lake Winnipesaukee somewhere. This is around the same time period. So my friend and I went out and stayed the night out there at a motel and went out to that bar where she was seen, I guess, seen in the bathroom at the bar. You know, these are just reports, you know, but... yeah, we of course we followed up on them. You know, I had like 30 reports of a plane flying around that day that it disappeared, and you know, it's hard to tell whether it was that plane or not. But
right, and none of those reports led to you finding the plane.
No, they didn't lead to us finding the plane, but it's a possibility that they did see the same plane because When that plane crashed, it didn't burn like it should have if it had crashed, you know, at first. You know, it run pretty much out of fuel.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what it is. I'm not a psychologist, but there's something about this case and I think other cases, it sounds like, where people almost see what they want to see, right? We've had reports of sightings. Maura works at a gas station in Maine or one in New Hampshire. Things we've actually personally followed up on too. But I don't know if it speaks to this case or just like mysteries in general, but when people start to listen to this podcast or see the disappeared episode, they see Maura out there. I can't explain it, but I think it's part of the reason we're doing this documentary.
You know, I think Moore has one of those very familiar faces that you know, fits a lot of girls out there. Mm-hmm. But the thing with Moore is she always wore her hair up. I don't think there's any picture of her out there that has her hair down. She always wore her hair up.
Except at the crash site.
Yeah. It puzzles me that Butch Atwood, said her hair was down.
Right. I guess it could just speak to what we're talking about, and he just could have been wrong. I mean, you know, memories are definitely not 100% accurate, even though he had just seen that person. It's hard to just say, oh, because her hair is down, it wasn't her at the crash site. We got to look at everybody else who it could have been. I think you should do that, or people should do that. And we've even talked about that and done that a little bit. Who else could it be if it wasn't her? But in reality, it was almost definitely Maura at the crash site.
Right, Maura, after getting hit with an airbag, probably in the face, would probably jar some hair loose. Did you ever talk to Butch Atwood?
No, never even saw the guy. Fred had already talked to him before, you know, I even showed up.
Fred seemed pretty confident that Butch was a stand-up guy.
I believe so. I think he Fred might have thought that the because the cops are hiding things that you know maybe it was the police. I don't think he really gave much attention to Butch Atwood, but the police seem to be hiding stuff, so
You're saying Fred and yourself at that time thought the police were hiding something.
Oh yeah, the police, and they won't be honest with us, and they just seem to be hiding stuff. They won't call in the FBI. You get a missing person up here in Maine, and every missing person I've seen up here in Maine, they call in the FBI pretty much right away, and the FBI takes it over.
So it went beyond them protecting the case by not providing information to you. You know that they've actually lied to you.
No, I can't say that we know they've actually lied to us. They just seem to be covering up stuff.
That was my only hard-hitting question ever on this podcast.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that we knew that they were lying. No.
Right.
But, yeah, they're just something fishy with the police down there. There's a reason why they're not doing certain things. And reason, I don't know. Or a reason they didn't do certain things at night.
Let's talk about Rick Forcier and his sighting. Was that taken as credible by you or Fred or the search group?
There always seemed to be something fishy with that one. I kind of see, because if I recall correctly, I'm not sure if I do, that Rick Forcier, actually, he reported, lasted 2 weeks, and after Moore disappeared, he told his neighbor he thought he saw somebody on the road that night. Well, the Forcier had talked to the police before that and didn't come forth on what he had saw, and he told his neighbor about it, and his neighbor reported to the police, or whether his neighbor told Forcier to report it to the police, I don't know the whole story. But yeah, it just seems fishy that 2 weeks later he would tell his neighbor about it. And he also reported that Moore was trying to dodge away from cars, avoiding him. Yeah, and I believe she also, he said he thought that it was a man at first. Because, I don't know whether she had a hoodie on or not.
Right, heavy coat or something maybe.
Yeah, but I can see why Moore would be dodging cars if she had been drinking and not wanting to be seen.
Right.
Because she probably thought the cops at that time were after her.
When you stated that there was something fishy about Rick Forcier's statement, do you mean that you don't believe the statement, or you maybe think he saw something and knows it wasn't Moore, but he wants to get his, kind of interject himself into the case?
Yeah, it could go a little both ways. Maybe he was just trying to say, I saw something that night, and saw this person walking down the road. But I really don't see that happening. And why he was telling his neighbor, that puzzles me. Why? Because he had, if you look at his house is pretty much right on the corner of that Bradley Hill Road, and I think you can see Atwood's house from his house. And, but he was having his house worked on. I believe he had a motorhome, not a motorhome, but
a trailer. Mobile. Yeah,
yeah, in his driveway. So he was living in that. So all his back windows of everything would have been all looking over that street. If Moore wanted to disappear from the accident, that would have been my place of guess, that she would have gone is to his house. But now, knowing that the cabinet is up there, I'm thinking Moore was following somebody out there. And this is just my guess, but Moore was following somebody out there. She crashed her car. By the time this person got down the road and could find a place to turn around, he turned around, came back, and picked her up. And this is after Atwood, had been with her, and Atwood was in making a phone call. So that's probably why Atwood didn't see her taking off. And he was probably in calling the cops. This is what I think happened. It kind of makes sense to me.
Yeah, it certainly could be. I wonder if that was the case, why they were driving separate cars. If she wasn't planning to, escape her life and abandon her car there like that, it's puzzling. One thing I wanted to mention about Rick Force here is that no wonder he was looked into by law enforcement. It's not surprising after hearing that, that he may have told his neighbor and then his neighbor called the police and then he spoke to police. It's not surprising he was high on the suspect list for a while. And as far as we know, he could still be on that short list that law enforcement has. And especially because he was doing construction to his house at that time. Obviously, there have been rumors that she's still there or she's where he was working. So we're not sure, really sure how far law enforcement took those leads, but it's not surprising to hear the path that it took to get to the police, why they view him as a suspect or viewed him as a suspect.
I think all of us have always suspected him. You know, it's just hard not to. It just seems too weird that he come forward 2 weeks later. You know, he must have heard everybody talking about it within days, you know, of her disappearing. That he must have. And there were signs up everywhere. And
there were people searching the area right around his house, right?
No. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, because the search didn't start until, what, 2 or 3 days later? Yeah, they would have been all over his house. So he must have known. I don't know why he came out with it 2 weeks later that he saw her.
Knowing the spot where Rick Forcier says he sighted Maura, just curious if you guys followed up back then on that sighting. Like, did you go right into the woods right from that spot?
You know, like I said, I came out there 2 to 3 weeks later. You can't really go into the woods at that time of year. You just look for any footprints. You don't even have to go into the woods.
I guess, assuming that Rick Forcier's sighting was real, did you guys ever put your head into what would have been Maura's head if she was running and dodging cars like Rick said? And then from the spot where he says he sighted her, where she would have gone, or if she went into the woods or anything like that? I know you searched, you would have covered that area, but I'm just wondering if you ever attempted that.
The very first thing I ever tried to do in this, when I first started on this, was get into Maura's head. What were the signs around that she was looking at? What, you know, was there, you know, so many miles to this place, so many miles to that place? Which way would she have gone? And even at the location that Forcier saw her, they did do a search. I believe that was probably about 3 to 4 weeks later, out around that area. And I actually went out there that weekend. And I got out there on, yeah, I actually went out there Sunday, I believe. But I didn't see any search going on, but apparently they said they did a search out there.
What was your relationship with the family members when you first arrived there? And do you continue to have any communication with them at this time?
No, not so much this time, at this time. I was very, you know, strong with Fred, you know, for the first 3 years, and then it just petered out. You know, I think both of us, you know, both of us had to start getting on with our lives. I got involved with, you know, Tim and Kathleen a couple of years afterwards. About, you know, 4 or 5 years afterwards. I think the last time, actually, that I saw Tim, about 4 years ago, he came up because my father passed away. And so he came up here and stayed here with his new wife. And but Tim and Kathleen had come over here before and gone swimming and everything. I think haven't really talked to too many people in the past 4 or 5 years anyways.
So at least for those first 3 years. So it was a consistent search for a year. And then how often after that year would you search? And how did those searches get initiated?
Yeah, the second year, it dropped down to about every other weekend, mm-hmm. for a full second year. you know, we would just go on leads that we had coming in, or on, you know, working on the psychic reports. And that was basically it for the second year.
And what was the what was the third year like?
Oh, the third year was just like I said, just random stuff, and then just kind of petered out. I mean, it petered out for me, I had my difficulties back then, but and basically Fred didn't really call me anymore to go searching or anything. So
when he did call you to go on searches, how did that go?
Oh, it went fine. Fred, you know, he'd beat around the bush. He'd say he's going out there. You know, he's got this lead to follow up on. But, you know, I could tell he wanted, you know, some help. So, you know, I'd offer to go out there. He'd never come out and ask my help. No, he'd leave it in my hands to go out there and help him out.
I like that way of thinking. He would call you and he would say, "I'm going up," and then just kind of like leave it there for you to say, "Okay, I'll join you."
Yeah. It's basically how it went, you know.
Yeah.
Fred's a modest man. I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, and I also feel like that's a way of because you don't want to bring anybody up there and force them into doing something because their head's not going to be in it, their heart's not going to be in it. And I feel like he's letting you know so that you can, you know, make your own decision to go. And if you decide to go as an adult, you realize, you know, that you have a job to do now, and it wasn't no one's forcing you into it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the way Fred is. He's a good guy.
When you guys would go out afterwards for dinner, who paid?
Fred would always take care of the bill. There was one time, and I think, you know, this is well after 2 years, you know, this is well into the second year, that you know, I asked for everybody to chip in. We'll pay for Fred this one time. Oh, he threw a fit. He threw a fit about it. But, you know.
Did you end up paying for him?
Yeah, because he was pretty mad about it.
I love that.
You know, like I said, he's pretty modest. He, you know, we're out there for him, and he wants to take care of us. We of course, we do all pay for our own motel rooms, and the woman that owned the motel at that time discounted our rooms because of the cause we were doing. So, so it wasn't all that expensive. After about that third year, I believe it was Maura's mother that passed away. Fred was, trying to get things straightened out there too, and trying to, you know, he had the house to deal with, and so he had to do a lot of, you know, fixing up the house and, dealing with that loss and, I believe they were divorced. But, he got the house anyway. But, yeah, he had to deal with a lot with that, and he was dealing with a lot with his work and everything. Usual life stuff.
So if you could get the chance to head back up there and search some areas or talk to some people, I'm guessing that the UMass cabin would probably be at the top of your list, but is there any other, is there anything else up there that you'd want to look into?
No, I think the UMass cabin, if there was any place I would else want to search, nothing really comes to mind. I think that area of 142 where that UMass cabin is probably, that needs to be searched. We did search parts of it and stuff, but that cabin, all around that cabin needs to be searched. I don't know if it ever was or anything, but.
Yeah, and I like that answer, and that's kind of what I wanted to hear, which was you pretty much exhausted every possibility when you were there in the first place. A lot of people who are new to the case, you know, think that you know, something's going to be there that was overlooked, but you know, you guys exhausted all possibilities at the time. So if there's something new that's come up, like this UMass cabin, and you're telling us that, you know, it wasn't really known at the time, then I think that is the most important thing to take from your, you know, your opinion of what's needed to be looked into up there.
Yeah. I'd just say areas around that UMass cabin, you know, but you figure the snow is on the ground. You know, you can't dispose of a body or anything. It's very difficult. All lakes and rivers, you know, are all, you know, frozen over. Back then, there was a lot of areas you could rule out just by thinking that. You know, so you're just basically looking for footprints or anything. But even if somebody was to drag somebody out into the woods and dispose of them, you know, the animals would, you know, scatter everything everywhere anyway. So it'd be on top of the ground and it wouldn't be below the ground. I mean, it's searching out there. Even if you look at where her crash site is, on my way out there, I always had to cross the Kangamangas Highway. So on my way out there and going back home, you know, I'd search that very heavily. The Kangamangas Highway. So you're looking at least 40 miles maybe, you know, from the crash site to so I've searched that area, and that's 40 miles out. You know, of course we went to I believe it was Bretton Woods where she looked up, directions to, but if she was going to Bretton Woods, she would have gotten off of 93 in Lincoln. Yeah, so I don't believe she was going in that area at all. I believe she was going in this one particular area for a reason.
Did you ever stop by the Swiftwater Stage Shop while you were there and talk to the owners?
No, and those owners have been talked to so many times by Fred, by the other searcher there. There was no need for me to do it.
Okay, but yes, but someone from that investigative team did talk to them.
Oh yeah, very highly. Yeah, you know, someone should point that these people are beat up by people talking to them. You know, I can remember one of your podcasts where you know, John Smith was talking to Westman's, I believe it was.
Yeah,
and he seemed to get a little irritated with John Smith, and you know, because John Smith is adamant that the car didn't hit that tree, and you know, and the Westmans are adamant that it did. It was just sitting right there.
Getting that sense of what it was like back then from you is it's been pretty eye opening for me. There's some stuff that I, you know, never really think about.
Want to thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about this. I know it was a very difficult time in a lot of people's lives, and it's probably not the best memories for you to bring all these back up and everything. But as Lance said at the beginning, really do think that it's important to put out there some of these truths that you lived right along Fred, you know, with Fred Murray, and I think this will help a lot.
You gotta know Fred, and you know, he seemed very sincere to me, and he, like I say, he's a modest man. He gets troubled. He really gets heartfelt and at times, and he gets comical at times. So you know, he's a person. So, but in my eyes, he did everything that he could do. And, you know, we all did.